Write it all down. Okay, go ahead. The old days, you couldn't publish an idea without publishing an experiment to go with it. In other words, it wasn't honorable for an organic chemist to publish a purely theoretical paper. Mm-hmm. And it took people like Hoffman and Walt Hoffman and Michael Doerr and Jack Roberts to break this down. Mm-hmm. And of course what they did was to write a whole lot of structures that they calculated energies for.
Yeah.
And as a result of this, this stimulated large numbers of chemists to make compounds that they would never have thought of making before. Mm-hmm. In other words, the people that can see interest in a given problem aren't always the ones that are able to synthesize the compounds. And if it was taboo to pass that information around in journals, there was this sort of a blockage of science by an artificial taboo. Mm-hmm. Well, I watched that dissolve. That was a good thing to get rid of. Mm-hmm. And I think probably that's one reason why U.S. science has prospered. It got rid of that taboo perhaps faster than some of the other countries, journals in other countries.
Yeah.
And then, of course, that opened the idea for other kinds of ideas, not only based on theory, but based more on intuition or less rational grounds to get stuff into the literature. Mm-hmm. I remember publishing my first paper without any kind of experiment at all was on the mapping of stereochemical reaction cycles. This is a long paper, and I was just astonished that here I can make something out of nothing and publish it in the JCS. do you understand?
Yes.
Well, this is some kind of a breakthrough in American education.
Yeah. There were a lot of thought processes that went into this, not, it's a time-consuming process just to formulate.
The historical outcome of this was that, you see, everybody is an equally endowed as to thinking about given subjects, nor are they experimentally endowed in effecting a synthesis or carrying out an experiment. And of course, man does a lot better by implementing each other's talents, by complementing each other. Pauling would have never amounted to a roll of pins if he hadn't gathered around himself some very critical people to check on his wildness.
Yeah.
He was a guy just absolutely chock full of new, interesting and wild notions, and he was smart enough to know that some of these were wild, and so he got some very clever people, both good experimentalists and good theoreticians around him to criticize what he did. And as a result of this, he did some remarkable things before he was 50.
Yeah.
And had a very profound effect on organic chemistry, among other things. And that was complementariness. Well, if you can do it on a national or even an international basis, you can do it in effect by the people that dream getting their dreams in the literature, and the people that act getting their actions following up the dreams with actions, and not necessarily having it the same person.
Yeah.
Or even the same country.
Yeah.
So there's vastly more stimulation abroad. Some people made a profession of feeding on other, on theoreticians' notions. That's been one of the themes for this, particularly the synthesis of hydrocarbons, particularly strained hydrocarbons or oddly shaped hydrocarbons or unusual. Degenerate.
I was just going over one of the
Bulling is an example.
Jack Roberts' papers, and the thing that he did with Strightwell in about 1952 or so, where they did just a whole series of calculations.
That's an example. That was a sort of a breakthrough paper.
Yeah.
Not so much in that it was really beautiful, hot stuff. It was pretty nice stuff, but what it did was to open that door.
Yes. First, I think. Probably open it. I think some organic chemists had used quantum mechanics before that, but not
But they hadn't published something in the journal that
right.
demonstrated that it was possible to publish these kind
yeah.
of notions in
yeah.
the journal.
That's right.
And then the synthetic organic chemist jumps on it and starts making some of these things.
Yeah. What were you going to say about the transition state theory?
What I was going to say, the organic chemist really couldn't think clearly, in my view, about organic reaction mechanisms until the transition state theory was incorporated in the body of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I haven't combed and looked through Ingold's stuff for the express purposes of asking myself the question, did he really use and understand the transition state theory? But I got the impression from reading his papers that he used it less than he should have, and he used it less than the Americans did.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly he worried about it in the SN2 and the E2 reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But once beyond that, he didn't give it much thought. He may have been aromatic substitution.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't looked those papers over carefully, and I haven't looked at them as a historian would want to look at them.
Mm-hmm.
Because the historian, of course, wants to be accurate, and somebody talking the way I'm talking
right.
doesn't necessarily have to be. He just has impressions.
Yes.
But that was one of Saul's strengths. I think that he had a good command of the ideas involved in transition state theory, and he was interested in both coordinates. Both the reaction coordinate and the energy coordinate.
Mm-hmm.
And it was putting of these two together that I think was a great deal of genius
mm-hmm.
involved. And it brought, what's sort of interesting is that the stereochemical probe helped you on the reaction coordinate a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, kinetics helped you on the energy coordinate a great deal, that and equilibrium for his kinds.
Yeah.
And thermal the burning of compounds and all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the merging of the concept of structure and the concept of rate in transition state theory that really provided a very powerful way of thinking
mm-hmm.
for the organic chemist to put together reaction mechanisms. Now, what's sort of interesting to me is that as far as I can see, the Woodward-Hoffman stuff in the early phases of it essentially ignore transition state theory.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, they deal with it more.
Mm-hmm.
Hoffman does.
Yeah.
But not in the early stuff. They worried more about the overall pathway of what orbitals hooked up with what other orbitals, not where the maximum and minima were on the reaction coordinate. You get the idea?
Yeah.
It was more of the kineticist and the stereochemist that worried about that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now as the applications of the Woodward-Hoffman notions fell into the hands of the physical organic chemists, the transition state theory got applied to it much more.
Yes.
But initially, the Woodward-Hoffman rules and orbital symmetry considerations were really of a lot more use to the synthetic organic chemists than they were really to the physical organic
mm-hmm.
chemists. You get the idea?
Yeah.
They strengthened the hand of the synthetic organic chemist
yeah.
because he gave him a degree of predictability
yes.
and design.
Well, I think that Woodward's probably worried more about that, and that's I remember his discussing some of the inconsistencies in the Diels-Alder reaction in the late 50s in one of his seminars, and he just found a hard time to explain this, and it wasn't until a few years later that Hoffman came to work with him.
Now, if you read Woodward, both Woodward and Dewar published some of the most asinine papers in the late 50s, as I recall, having to do with the Diels-Alder
reaction.
Uh-huh. And if you read those, they're essentially uninformative.
Mm-hmm.
You can't tell what they're saying.
Uh-huh.
But what was obvious was that these papers were the thought processes
yeah.
that they were going through,
right.
and they were asking questions and trying to arrive at orbital symmetry theory
yeah.
in publishing those stupid papers.
Yeah.
And they were stupid. It was later that things
yeah.
started to get more orderly.
Well, Wood was very worried about these you know, the way these molecules were coming together. I mean, you know, he was concerned about stepwiseness and why they always worked in a particular fashion.
Those two guys were like Gilbert and Sullivan, Wood
really?
And Hoffman. Sure.
Yeah.
One without the other couldn't have done
yeah,
the damn
right.
thing.
No, that's absolutely true. Yeah, yeah. Wood knew the problem was there.
I yes, and
he could
was,
not have
he
solved
was phenomenal,
it.
He was phenomenologically oriented,
yeah.
and Hoffman was intellectually, or rather mathematically and theoretically oriented.
Right. Yeah.
And
he
and understand
the right
mathematical
time.
Language
that's
to,
right.
to handle it.
That's right. He came along just at the right time to solve that aspect of the problem. Yeah, Woodward could not have done.
Now, I think the tremendous advantage that my generation had that the early generation didn't is that we did have transition state theory to hang our hat on.
I see.
When we were educated.
Yeah.
Therefore, it became second nature to think in terms of the difference between an intermediate and a transition state and how long lived was it and how much lower was it in energy and what was its structure and all
yeah.
the interesting and right questions.
Yeah.
And how do you get at these questions?
Mm-hmm.
You get the idea?
Yes.
Now, this was what, to me, was the revolution. That and instrumentation that occurred in the
mm-hmm.
over the period of my lifetime.
Yeah.
Instrumentation on the one hand and the windows that were opened on structure and on mechanism mm-hmm. by the instruments.
I think that's been very, very helpful.
Of course, stereochemistry, mm-hmm. just one other thing.
Yeah, sure.
NMR revolutionized stereochemistry.
Yeah.
Because it brought a whole domain of stereochemistry into play that had been not on the human time scale.
Mm-hmm.
It gave humans another time scale to work with.
Yeah.
And so stereochemistry and some of the old terms, in fact, there's a great deal of confusion in the field of stereochemistry with regard to terminology that grew out of this human time scale, then the NMR time scale.
Yeah. We're just using the same names and
yes, and confusing them.
Yeah.
Because one, a lot of the terms are operational. And if something racemizes on the human time scale, or an inversion occurs on the human time scale, it's a different time scale than
yes.
on the NMR time scale.
Right.
And a lot of the terms are transferred back and forth, mm-hmm. and pretty soon people don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yes. Yes.
And the question is, are you talking about absolute zero, or are you talking about 120 degrees absolute, or
yeah.
and so forth?
Yeah,
a lot of complications, but a lot of interesting complications.
Yeah. Yeah.
This type of thing. We could talk about that for quite a while, but I think I'm just opening up these subjects.
Yes. So
as to alert you to
sure
to notions that other people might be interested in
yeah.
talking about too.
I think so. Let me digest what you've told me already, and then I may come back.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm sorry. Okay. This has been a little unstructured and a little random.
I think it's better this way, in a way.
Well, first go around.
Yeah. We managed to get a lot of the questions answered. I was flipping through the cards, and it's because you'd answered a lot of the questions already. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.